In the new book, Privacy, in 18 short chapters, Garrett Keyser considers the moral dimensions of privacy in relations to issues of social justice, economic inequality, and the increasing commoditization of the global marketplace. Though acutely aware of the digital threat to privacy rights, Keyser chooses not to view the issue in purely technological terms or as an essentially legalistic value. Instead, he asks, what happens to our private selves when we cannot escape surveillance? It is a great pleasure to welcome Garrett Keyser to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be at the table.
This book is part of the Big Ideas Small Books series from Picador. It is a series that has looked at many provocative short books, inviting us to rethink our biggest ideas. What brought you to do this for this particular purpose and look at privacy?
Well, on the practical side, what brought me to do the book for Picador is an essay that I'd published for Harper's and an agent who was aware of the series and thought I might be suited to it. What brought me to the subject was, I think, what brings many people to the subject, which is the realization that privacy is of a special interest to us, the way our environment is, because we see both under attack, and also because I was interested in exploring some of the seeming contradictions in my own personality between my love of privacy and even of reclusiveness, and yet a politics that's very concerned with social issues.
So for you, did you have to start out with a definition of privacy, of how you define that?
I didn't start out with that in my book or in my brainstorming for the book. I didn't start out with it in the book because I worried that it, you know, starting with a definitive definition might turn off a reader, and also because I wanted to feel my way into the definition. In fact, the chapter that I wrote, chapter 3, in which I attempt my own definition, was actually the last chapter I composed in putting the book together. And I'm glad of that, because it means that my tentative thoughts toward defining privacy were based on an honest investigation and some serious rumination. Privacy is not always easy to define, and there are many definitions of it, and some scholars would claim that trying to define it is nigh to impossible. And yet, as I'm fond of saying, if you got a few people together on a desert island who've been washed ashore with none of their possessions and none of their clothes, pretty soon you would find common ground in terms of privacy needs, and with some individual differences. But usually when you talk to someone about privacy, they know roughly what you mean.
You do say at the beginning of that chapter that the first thing we can say by way of defining privacy is that it exists only by choice.
Yes, and that's not everyone would agree with that, but I think it helps very much if we think of privacy as something that we choose. As I say in that, I believe, the same paragraph you're referring to, that minus choice, work becomes slavery, sex becomes rape, singing a song goes from an act of joyous expression to an act of humiliation. If we choose something, it's beautiful to make that choice. It certainly, having it forced on it, is not. So that when we talk, or as some writers will say, that, you know, historically, some women have had too much privacy in the sense that they've been sequestered in their houses or they've been kept from public life. I would prefer not to call that too much privacy, but not enough liberty in choosing where they wish to be private and where they wish to be public.
You have a fascinating discussion in the book as well about privacy and loneliness, and that confusion over the two.
Yes, I think that, sometimes people will talk about you know, the seeming frivolity with which people will cast away their privacy. Look at how people just expose themselves and give up their privacy. Well, given my grounding of the definition in choice, if someone's willingly exposing themselves, they're really not giving up their privacy. They're exercising their right to privacy. But one reason I think we see that phenomenon is because people in our society, or many of them, are in fact lonely and unacknowledged, and human beings crave some kind of acknowledgement of themselves and of their worth and of their work. So it's no surprise to me that as we degrade work and as we degrade community and as we degrade the environment on which those things depend, that we're also increasing loneliness and often confusing it with privacy.
And as you mentioned before, some of us, we long for isolation. We long to get away from it all. But isolation here again is not loneliness and is not privacy.
Some would say that the chosen isolation is one dimension of a definition of privacy. What we feel and enjoy when we wish to seclude ourselves from others. And others would define privacy as the exercise of controlling our access, deciding when we wish to be available to people and when we wish not to be. I've always found it interesting that two of the religious leaders, perhaps most popularly credited with compassion toward others, the Buddha and Jesus. If you look at their lives, at least as they've come down to us in the record, they're characterized by a rhythm of being with others and being with others very intensely and then going aside for reflection and rest and recreation. And we recognize that. It's a common ground with these great figures, that most of us feel that need too. I think there may be some people who want to be alone all the time, and there may be some people who are very uncomfortable with any kind of isolation, and that diversity is part of the beauty and mystery of humanity. But I think most of us require some kind of mix, and indeed, we require those two states, isolation and sociability, as means of nurturing the other. The theologian Bonhoeffer has an interesting and often quoted sentence, and I probably won't quote it exactly, but he says something like, "Let the one who is afraid to be in community be afraid to be alone, and let the person who's afraid to be alone beware of being in community." A person who can't be alone at all is probably a dangerous person to have with others. And likewise, somebody who's afraid of being with others at all is probably a danger to himself when he's alone.
You make the point in the book that the word privacy never appears in the United States Constitution. It is not mentioned in U.S. court cases for over 100 years after the Declaration of Independence, and is not articulated as a right by the U.S. Supreme Court until the 20th century is well underway. But it has now become quite a part of our political dialogue.
Yes, and I tend to look at the facts that you've just laid out, not with a jaundiced eye, let's say. I think one of the beautiful things about our history, about all history, and about the history of our Constitution is that we have progressively come to deeper understandings of principles that, from our perspective, were not even fully understood by those who first framed those principles. So that when people said when Jefferson said, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, he was probably thinking primarily of white, European-descended, property-owning men. And most of us today would not have that understanding. the abolition of chattel slavery, which is protected now by an amendment to the Constitution, was not in the original Constitution either. And there are people who meet each other and enjoy each other's company and actually love each other long before they say, I love you. But it's implicit from the start, or almost from the start, just as children may come along and be derived from that relationship that develops. And so in the same way, we've thought about privacy, and we've developed this right of privacy, which was more implicit than explicit in the original Constitution. But I would argue that its basis was implicit in the understandings that gave rise to the Constitution.
So where are we now when it comes to privacy? Is it under attack? Is it a luxury we can no longer afford in this age of terrorism? Is it obsolete?
Well, I'm always skeptical of the phrase, you know, a luxury we can't afford. Whenever someone tells me that a right of mine or even a pleasure of mine is a luxury we can no longer afford, I want to know a few things. First of all, is it really a luxury? Second, is the person who's telling me that willing to deprive themselves of the same luxury that they're telling me I can't afford? And third, what might their agenda be in telling me that? And that's a nice transition to the second part of your question, which is, you know, is privacy under attack? It certainly would appear to be, and from various sources, it's under attack because we as a nation are under attack in an age of global terrorism, and I can talk about that too if you wish. We're under attack through various marketing strategies, and both those marketing strategies and government surveillance are enabled at an unprecedented level by technological tools that enable us to seek out each other and each other's information. And finally, I think that privacy may be under attack by a culture which, for various reasons, has encouraged people, A, to believe that their privacy isn't that important, and B, that even if it is important, it's something that they have to get used to losing because the almighty market, or the almighty technology with a capital T, has thus decreed it, and therefore bring your virgins to the volcano and toss them in.
When you look at the specific arguments of how we use the word privacy, if I'm a private person and I do not want to disrobe in some way, shape, or form as I'm going through the line at the airport versus concern that information that I'm accessing on my computer is being viewed by a third, fourth, or fifth party, these are all arguments, but very different, obviously.
They are. I mean, privacy encompasses a lot, and there are some scholars who've spent a lot more time with the subject than I have, but whom I trust, who would suggest that the quicker we can move beyond the blanket definition toward the specifics that we cover with that word privacy, what exactly are we trying to protect and how protected should it be, that the sooner we move in that direction towards specificity, the better. There's always going to be tension between competing values. I think you're implying one between privacy and security. There's a long-standing historical tension between First Amendment rights and privacy. I think it's foolhardy to deny those tensions. I think they're a part of living in a democracy, and they're a part of living thoughtfully and intentionally. Where I have a problem is where people argue in the name of a pressing threat or a pressing need that we resolve those tensions simplistically, and that we simply say, well, we now, for instance, are faced with a threat from abroad, we're faced with terrorism, and therefore we can no longer give any thought to privacy. I was thinking the other day, you know, of Paul Revere riding through the streets and saying the British are coming, the British are coming, and colonists taking muskets down from their walls and running out in the streets to meet the British. Now we're told the global terrorists are coming, and so toss the Constitution into the fireplace and drop your drawers for a strip search. I don't deny that the wolf is at the door, but what I take exception with is the idea that the best way to defend against the wolf is to turn a citizenry into sheep, a prospect which would please no one so much as terrorists themselves or anyone else bent on our destruction as a society. And I would think those people would also be delighted to see us destroying some of our values in the effort to defend ourselves, so that what we're defending no longer exists even as it once was, because we ourselves have diminished it out of fear.
One of the things I thought about in reading the book that came to my mind, and you wrote about it, when you look at the Patriot Act, and something now that we've lived with for almost a decade, of how then, if that is to change, and there are aspects of that that are quote-unquote loosened, can you put that toothpaste back in the tube? Can we then gain privacy, or is what is lost lost?
Well, I don't think that anything that seems completely lost is ever lost. And if I did believe that, then I'd give up on a lot of folks I've known who seemed lost and who were then found. Historically, it's interesting that for something like 200 years, the Japanese, who were expert gunmakers and gunsmiths, decided that they didn't like guns, and they did without them. The samurai outlawed them, which refutes the idea that, you know, there's a certain historical development and there's absolutely no turning back. And the other side of that is that things can be turned back, not only in a redemptive way, but they can sometimes be turned back in a bad way. I sometimes think that our triumph over fatalism that was accomplished in the Enlightenment, where we were no longer willing to accept someone sickening and dying as the will of the divine, that now we're going back to this kind of fatalism where, you know, the market or the needs of security or terrorism means that there's no way to turn things back. In terms of, more specifically, the Patriot Act, I would love to know how many people, the Patriot Act originally was something like 320 pages long. I would love to know how many of the people who voted for it even had the time to read it all. And I'll throw myself into the mix and say that I've studied some things around it and in it, but I've not read it all. So maybe one step toward putting some toothpaste back into the tube is knowing what exactly it is we've accepted as a given, and what some of its implications are. But if we are a democracy, and if we are rational beings capable of self-government, then we are able to change our minds about things that were done hastily or that seem to have been a mistake, or to modify our judgments. And if we are not, then the exercise of writing books or talking about privacy or you and I having this conversation are essentially exercises in futility.
But you look at, and I guess I think of this because I have an 11, 12-year-old nephew who was born in a time where he doesn't know any better. For us, it is a difference. It is a very stark difference. But for him, who will be voting in 5 or 6 years, doesn't know any better, doesn't know any different.
Well, he might not know any different, although I would just raise two possible caveats. One, is it true that he doesn't know any different? And two, if he doesn't, is he typical of his entire generation? I realize that the received narrative right now is that young people don't care about privacy, or they care about it much less than the generations before them did. I'm not sure. I do not know enough to say that that is sound social analysis, or it's just sly marketing. So you're young, you're cool, and here's the story, kid. You're part of the generation who doesn't care about privacy, and therefore, buy this legislation that lessens your privacy, and make sure you spend all of your time on social networking sites. And I'll go one step further and say, let's, for the sake of argument, assume that narrative. The prevailing narrative about the generation without privacy is correct. Let's just, for the sake of argument, buy it, even though I'm reluctant to buy it. That raises the question of why. Where did that come from? Did this idea suddenly just spring like Athena from the brain of Zeus out of these kids' minds? Or is this something that they have learned from their culture and from their elders? And I would strongly nod my head toward the latter possibility. They have grown up with technological tools, not only given to them, as they should be, but given to them with the understanding on the part of their teachers, their parents, and everyone else that this is the way to go. This is your ticket to being a respectable member of the human race. This is a tool, but it's not necessarily a tool to be used critically. It's to be embraced the same way that young people in China's Cultural Revolution were told, you know, to embrace Chairman Mao. This is the little red book, except it happens to be an iPod or an iPad. And second of all, they've been raised in a society where just by looking at pay scales, I mean, we express our values and our culture through money. And just by pay scales, there's nothing higher or more important than a celebrity. So along comes technologies and social networking sites that give you the chance to try on celebrity, to at least ape that phenomenon that everybody bows before. Can we blame them if that's what they've embraced? But again, I have to believe that those younger than myself have at least what intelligence I have to critique what's fed to them. Because if that intelligence isn't there, and that willingness to look not only to the future, but also to the present and the past, if those things are not there, then very soon everything, not just privacy, but everything we subsume under the name democracy will no longer be there. And that's just a destiny that I refuse to accept.
Well, you speak about marketing, and this book is marketed as a small book with big ideas, and it's certainly the case. And
thank you.
I thank you very much for speaking to us about it. The name of the book is Privacy. It's by Garrett Kaiser. It's published by Picador. Garrett, thank you very much for spending time with us and sharing your expertise. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Privacy by Garrett Kaiser, published by Picador. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.